This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. I'd like now to welcome back to the Radio Cafe Christopher Bohm. He's director of the Jane Goodall Research Center, and he's a professor of biological sciences and anthropology at the University of Southern California in Los Angeles. He's author of the book Moral Origins, The Evolution of Virtue, Altruism, and Shame. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So let's talk about hunter-gatherers. First of all, what's the definition of hunter-gatherers? What geographies are we talking about? What time periods and kind of general ways of life?
Hunter-gatherers are the original humans, in a sense, very strong sense. They do not domesticate plants. They have domesticated dogs for at least 15,000 years, but that's about it. Not horses, nothing like that. And they have been modern like us in the sense that their brains and their cultural sensitivities and so forth have been modern for at least 45,000 years. And they developed this capacity for culture in Africa and then moved to Europe roughly 35, 40,000 years ago. And that's where they painted the beautiful cave paintings that tell us that they are very, very much like us. However, those skills and arts were developed in Africa and then migrants brought them to Europe. So modern hunter-gatherers can be used as models for the ones that were behaviorally modern, let's say 45,000 years ago. And one thing I do is to study modern hunter-gatherers to see how much of their behavior can be projected into the past.
Well, that's one thing I was wondering about. I mean, we have cave paintings, we have archaeology, and yet the hunter-gatherers who still exist have pretty much universally, correct me if I'm wrong, had contact with the outside world and with non-hunter-gatherer societies, and that contact presumably has influenced them.
Yes, that is a liability that anthropologists and archaeologists face if they want to use today's hunter-gatherers as models for the past. However, there have been a few hunter-gatherers who were studied at the moment of contact. For example, Greenland Eskimo or Inuit people were studied the minute the explorer, the boats got there, the ships, Scandinavian anthropologists on board, and they were able to write down the behaviors and customs of the people. And we find that what they recorded is not that different from most hunter-gatherers, even though they may have had some contact. When the contact results in very radical technical innovations, like, say, firearms, for example, or when people are basically subjugated through colonial systems, then you have radical changes. But many, many of the hunter-gatherers, and there are at least 300 that have been studied by anthropologists, at least half of them are in, let's say, something like their original condition.
And this information exists in a hunter-gatherer database that you've done a lot of work with. Tell us about this database.
Well, there are 339 hunter-gatherer societies that have been recorded by anthropologists. Of these, about 150 are not that dissimilar from what their predecessors were like. And what we've done is to, so far, code, which means to take a outline of cultural behaviors and then code the ethnographic reports for these people. We've done 66 out of the 150 so far. So we have a growing database, which gives a statistical basis for making generalizations about these people worldwide. Unfortunately, some of the world areas where the hunter-gatherers still live have only a few groups, such as South America, Asia, Africa, North America to a certain extent. However, in Australia and with the Inuit in the Arctic, we have large numbers of hunter-gatherers who have been studied and were studied before any radical changes took place from modernization. So overall, we have a growing statistical base, and we can use that information to project it back at least 45,000 years.
When you project back 45,000 years, how do you do that? I mean, okay, I'm Sicilian on one side, and I could go back to the village where my grandparents grew up. If I project back 45,000 years based on how Sicilian peasants were living, let's say, when they emigrated to America, how accurate would that be? And how is that the same and different with hunter-gatherers?
Well, hunter-gatherers are constrained. Now, there are two kinds of hunter-gatherers that lived back in the Upper Paleolithic. One type was people who were nomads, meaning that they didn't have a permanent home base. They moved around because they followed their resources and maximized the quality and quantity of food that they could obtain.
And there's quite a bit of that here in the Southwest.
Oh, yes, but mainly with Pueblo Indians,
right,
who were agriculturalists, but were probably forced to become hunter-gatherers once in a while when there were severe droughts. Now, that would be a case which I would not include in my database because they really already experienced horticulture, and that profoundly changes things. You start storing food, and all kinds of things change when you start storing food. So hunter-gatherers don't store food very much. However, if we're looking at what is the basis for projecting modern behaviors backwards in time, there is a certain amount of debate about that. There are some people who do not like the use of ethnographic analogy, which is the technical term for doing this. Hunter-gatherers today are doing things that resonate with what little we know about their social and political life archaeologically. One thing that we know from archaeology is that when they find a campsite, that there are multiple hearths. And what we know today is that each family in a band has its own hearth, its own fire. And basically families cook as units, and they share vegetable and small game, vegetable foods and small game, within that family unit. But they live in a band, and the entire band of maybe 30 people shares all the large game that anyone in the band manages to capture. So these are things that you can figure out archaeologically, then you can see that they also take place today. And on that basis, we can start projecting other behaviors that for which there's not even an archaeological trace.
So let's talk about the subject of your talk, hunter-gatherer morals. In what ways, I mean, you have studied these folks. Are hunter-gatherers like and unlike the agricultural civilizations that followed, and really like and unlike us?
They are very much like us, really. They're down on things like murder and theft. And one thing that they seem to universally proscribe also is the breaking of taboos. I'm not sure we could parallel that for all modern people, but there's still a certain amount of that hovering around. Incest is universally proscribed by all humans and often punished severely. Other behaviors such as lying, being deceitful, those are proscribed. Cheating, cheaters are disliked. And
proscribed meaning against the rules.
Yeah, proscribed meaning you do it, you pay. Either by bad public opinion that sort of wrecks your reputation and constrains your social opportunities, or hunter-gatherers can become really severe in their punishment.
What does that look like? It's essentially law enforcement.
Yes, it's law enforcement in the sense that you have rules and breakers of rules are punished. But it's not like law enforcement, in which you have individuals who are responsible for law enforcement as specialists. The entire group is the specialist. And what happens when somebody, let's say, throws his weight around unduly and gets other people turned off by this behavior, is that at first you might have some criticism, or people simply disobey him if he tries to give an order. But if he becomes really dominant and starts bossing people around and has them intimidated, next thing he knows, he's being killed. And it's very interesting to watch the way in which hunter-gatherers dispose of these unbearable bullies. In one case, with the Kung San people of the Kalahari, the entire group tried to kill the bully, but they used poison arrows, and it takes quite a while to die from a poison arrow, an hour or so. And he managed to inflict a lot of injury back on them. But normally the way you dispose of a bully is that the entire group agrees he's got to go, and then they delegate his close male kinsmen to kill him. The reason they do this is because if somebody kills somebody else in the group, there's always retribution. Hunter-gatherers are big on personal revenge. A kinsman of the person who was the victim will then kill the killer, and so forth. Sometimes it can go back and forth, so a number of people die. And the way you get out of this and avoid it is you delegate his brother or his close cousin, male cousin, to kill him. In that case, retribution doesn't make any sense because they're all in the same kin group.
I think of all the bullying prevention programs we have in the schools and all that kind of thing, and I was wondering, are there bullying prevention rituals, ways of life, stories in hunter-gatherer societies?
It's not a subject they're very fond of because it's an obnoxious, it goes beyond obnoxious. It goes against their entire view of how things should be. The way things should be is that all males in the group treat one another as political equals. Now, one may be a better hunter, one may be more powerful physically or whatever, but they cannot bully others. They cannot assert dominance over them. And the minute you even start looking like you're doing that, they'll give you clear cues that this doesn't go. Now, our school bullies basically are in a different social structure. It's a big playground, and there's a bunch of kids who basically go home. They don't live there, and so on and so forth. So it's not really like a band. And bullying is a serious problem because there are studies of human children in schoolyards that show that not only boys but girls develop spontaneously pecking orders, alliances, us against them. A lot of human nature comes out on the schoolyard, and the dominance tendency also. And usually it's the teacher's intervention. I remember a teacher tried to rally my fifth grade class at a private school I went to in Vermont against a serious bully. And she basically suggested that somebody whip him. And we had boxing at noon, and I managed to catch his head between my boxing glove and the sill of an outside window.
Good heavens.
And almost knocked him out. And I was maybe half of his size, and I became a school hero. Perhaps that has something to do with my interest in egalitarianism.
Well, it's interesting because, if you talk about those pecking orders as being part of human nature that asserts itself on many, if not every, schoolyard in the world for untold generations, what you're saying or what I'm hearing is that hunter-gatherers have all kinds of rules and child-rearing practices and so on in place to prevent that pecking order from being the way their society runs.
That's exactly it. Human beings, if you want to talk about by nature, something like a human nature, we very readily learn how to dominate. We also learn how to submit, because the two evolve together. And the result with domination and submission in a group that does not have morals is that you have a pecking order, as with chimpanzees or chickens, in which the various individuals have either had an encounter or have sized one another up, and they know who's going to win. So the predictable loser then defers to the predictable winner, and you've got a very smooth system, because if there's food, the big guy gets it and the little guy doesn't. But at least there's not a fight, because even the big guy can get hurt in a fight. So dominance orders are found in many, many species. And they basically permit a regular and organized and non-conflictive access to resources, even though the big guys come out ahead, both with food and mating.
Although in those kinds of groups, the non-dominant individuals are continually fighting among each other for essentially the crumbs that are left over.
They don't necessarily fight, because even they know who is going to be a top dog and a lower dog, even though they're both low dogs. So, but any dominance order does involve a certain amount of fighting, but it's usually when one individual is approaching the power of the other and then decides to go for it. And then you can have a reversal of dominance.
And for those of you, ladies and gentlemen, with more than one dog in your household, you've probably seen this.
Dogs, of course, are very dominance-oriented, and any dog trainer will tell you that you need to establish dominance over your dog. Don't be egalitarian with him.
Right, exactly.
Or her, yes.
We're talking to Christopher Bohm about hunter-gatherer morals. Now, when we talk about the evolution of morals in human beings, we're talking about something fundamentally different than that pecking order in primates and other higher animals that you were mentioning. And I guess part of what I'm asking is, I mean, we're saying there's really no moral code among any other creatures.
Absolutely.
Okay. So then the evolution of morality, how did it happen?
Well, we can find precursors in a reconstructed ancestor, which we arrive at by looking at the behaviors of chimpanzees, bonobos, and humans, all of whom share so much DNA it isn't funny. And if we have a behavior that takes place among all three species, we can pretty readily project it back to the ancestor 5 to 7 million years ago. And one thing we know about that ancestor is that it was very political. It formed coalitions within its groups. It lived in groups of at least 30. And these coalitions sometimes were males or females combining forces in order to raise their status in the hierarchy. But once in a long while, chimps and bonobos gang up against high-ranking male individuals. And when they gang up, it's a little bit suggestive of morality. Franz de Waal has studied chimpanzees in artificial enclosures in Atlanta, Georgia, and found that they form coalitions all the time, and that, in fact, once the females are in captivity and they don't have to spend all their time looking for food, they gang up against the males and cut down on male power very significantly. So these behaviors, when we project them back to an ancestor, that gives us a baseline for suggesting that humans have ganged up against individuals whose behavior they don't like ever since we became human and on back, because that behavior presumably has been continuous from our ancestral origins all the way up to the present.
So that counts as ganging up against somebody whose behavior you don't like counts as morality?
No, it doesn't, but it's certainly a major precursor. Morality is a very difficult thing to define, and philosophers have written tons of books about it. It don't do me too much good, because I'm interested in the nitty-gritty of morality. And the nitty-gritty of morality is the group doesn't like a behavior, and it cracks down on it. And the values that are shared by group members are morality in humans, but in chimps or bonobos, They're simply attitudes. We don't call them moral because they don't have that moral tone of voice, the ought, the should, and so forth, which philosophers talk about so much. And one thing that we can say about morality is that makes it distinctive is that humans have a conscience. And the conscience is basically, well, we tend to think of the conscience as being a noble thing that keeps us from doing bad. But a conscience, from an evolutionary standpoint, is an interchange in our front of our brain, which tells us which behaviors are going to get us credit, which ones discredit, and also how to avoid the discredit. And also, unfortunately, for those who would make the conscience a noble thing, the conscience also tells us what we can get away with. So,
what do you mean?
Well, let's say that I'm come to a red light at midnight. I was once a cab driver in Boston, Mass, or Cambridge, and I noticed that there was a general rule that all the cab drivers followed, which was after midnight, you don't pay attention to red lights. You just drive right through them. So, and this was a conscience looking at a moral code, which happened to be legal as well, and deciding, okay, here's a rule we can break, and with impunity.
Now that seems like, I don't know, that seems like not really a moral rule. That seems like the actual basis of that rule is how to avoid car accidents, and that there is a kind of practicality because you know other cars aren't coming, and presumably if you're a cab driver in Boston after midnight, you still kind of look around to see whether there are cars coming.
Sure.
But how is that? It doesn't seem moral, like not hurting another person or not killing somebody, things like that.
Well, law is different from morals in a sense. For example, property law often looks at things in a simply business-like way. Traffic lights are a little bit different. I mean, most people believe in traffic lights, and they stop for a red light even if there's no absolutely zero possibility of being detected if you go through it. And that would be the moral sense cutting in because it's a rule and it's a law. A law is simply a moral rule or a non-moral rule that is codified. And I take your point, but basically law and morality are pretty close. And some like civil law isn't moral, but criminal law is moral. And with a traffic light, it's sort of a combination of the two.
Well, let's talk for a moment more about conscience. So take a scenario in which somebody has badly hurt another person, or somebody's killed and murdered another person, gotten away with it, and at a certain point their conscience is so heavy that they turn themselves in. And there are stories like this.
Right.
That, I mean, it doesn't get them credit. It gets them in jail.
Well, in the first place, evolution is a sloppy process. So if a conscience has evolved as a way of individuals avoiding getting in trouble, I mean, that's how I see the conscience. The conscience is an internalization of moral rules. Because it's internalized, you might turn yourself in after you kill someone, even though nobody's going to catch you. But the internalization really is there because it makes you so effective at knowing the rules and avoiding getting in trouble that can cost you your reproductive success or your fitness. And so the conscience is an evolutionary mechanism which is quite effective, but it has some side effects that may not even help you. And that would be one of them, turning yourself in after you've done something you could have gotten away with.
We're talking to anthropologist Christopher Bohm about hunter-gatherer morality. Let's talk about how moral codes and rules and things about which one might have conscience, and I imagine conscience varies a great deal from one society to another, what you might feel guilty about or responsible for. But in the hunter-gatherer societies that you have studied, what is the role of, for example, dance and music and ritual and other common practices in enforcing and teaching moral codes?
Well, mythology would be the one I would go to. And mythology very often tries to explain morality. Hunter-gatherers are pretty philosophical in a very down-to-earth way, let's call it. And many myths talk about how animals became moral, like humans. Often it's an animal who becomes moral, but the real story is, how did humans become moral? We wonder, why are we so different from all these animals who get away, if they can get away with something, they do it. They're not worried about their peers, they don't have a sense of shame, and they don't seem to have any guilt. And so hunter-gatherers address this issue as a philosophical issue, and they do it through mythology. And very often myths talk about, it's not just how the chipmunk got his stripes, but it's how animals became moral, or some quasi-humans who were mostly animal became moral.
Are there any stories or myths of that kind from your research that you could tell us?
Probably not, because I tend to put that data on a back burner, because it's difficult to project something as variable as myth. I'm looking for universals. And myths, although the mythic form is pretty much found everywhere, the content of the myths are just so different that you can't really generalize about the actual content and which aspect of morality might be involved in a myth and so on. It'd be an interesting project for someday, but I haven't looked into it yet.
What are the issues around which moral codes and rules are formed? I mean, you talked about murder, you've talked about incest, you've talked about bullying. What about day-to-day practical things having to do, for example, with food?
Hunter-gatherers share their large game. They also have an optional sharing of small game or vegetable foods, but they come in such small packages that there's not really a need to share, because everyone can go out and get their own. With large game, it's hard to get. And once you have it, it's going to spoil if you hog it for yourself. Therefore, they have invariably developed practices. All hunter-gatherers share their large game at the band level. Now, here's something you could do if you killed, let's say, a wildebeest. You could hide it and sneak out there and eat it and not share it with the group. This would be such a heinous crime that you might even be killed for it. You certainly would be ostracized or shamed or possibly ejected from the group, because that is, to them, that is just unthinkable. We don't have too many actual examples of that, but we do have one where a guy who was sort of an aggressive, dominant kind of guy that people didn't like too well anyway, and he was an Mbuti pygmy. And they had a vast net hunt where all the men have huge nets, and then the women and children drive game into the nets. And what he did was put his net out ahead of the others, so he got more game, and he thought they wouldn't see him. They did see him. And this guy was basically insulted right and left, even by adolescent boys. They then went to his hut and grabbed all the illicit meat and confiscated it. And he claimed that he deserved a larger share because he was a big chief. They put him in his place. And the reason he was allowed to stay in the band was because they needed him and several allied families to have a good number of hunters. Otherwise, he would have been thrown away. Basically, he would have been ejected and could not have made a living without a band.
Another really important part of this conversation is the evolution of altruism. I mean, not only are you going up, like the story you just told, putting in their place people who do things that aren't good for the group, but people who really actually make sacrifices for the group. How do you see that having evolved?
Well, we might think about two types of altruism. One is altruism which is spontaneous, in the sense that you stand out among the variable human beings in your group as someone who is much more prone to give to others even if no reciprocation is available. There are other individuals who may be altruistic and give to others when no reciprocation is available, but they do it because they want to have a good reputation or because they want to avoid being punished by the group or disapproved of or whatever. So if we think about just the genuine altruism aspect, it's one of the great mysteries of evolutionary theory. And ever since Edward O. Wilson started the current interest in evolutionary biology of humans back in 1975, the problem of explaining altruism has been a profound one and a persistent one, because basically evolution is selfish. You do what you can for your own self in terms of increasing your fitness. And if you start giving stuff away, you lose out, your genes lose out, and that behavior loses out. Now, altruism can be explained. Darwin was very puzzled by this, and it can be explained by group selection, meaning that if you have more altruists in a group, it is going to win out over other groups because it is more cooperative, it flourishes, and also it can fight better, because people that go out and altruistically die for their groups, basically that advances the group's benefit, but it hurts their individual benefit. And the question is, could group selection cause altruism? And the answer is probably not by itself. It just isn't strong enough a force, because this individual, selfish, egoistic dimension is so strong. Another theory that's used to explain altruism is not really altruism. It's called reciprocal altruism, but basically it amounts to I scratch your back, you scratch mine. As long as it's equalized, we come out ahead of those who don't cooperate. And neither of us gains an advantage, so that the behavior can stay in place from the standpoint of genetics or gene pools. So that's another theory. There's also mutualism. By the way, reciprocal altruism was very much in vogue as a theory, and it turns out nobody does it. So that theory's now out.
Really? Nobody does I scratch my back? That's how Congress operates.
Yeah, but it never comes out equally in hunter-gatherer bands. Okay? And it's true, but it's the fact that it has to be equalized. And I'm sure sometimes, in fact, it is equalized. You just can't seem to find it going on as an important thing that would affect gene pools. Another thing would be social selection, which is my latest interest. And social selection means basically that if I am altruistic in my band, I'm giving away my resources and not getting anything in return, so that should put me at a disadvantage. However, because bands are moral and because they approve of altruists, then all of a sudden everybody wants to marry me, to be my economic partner, and all of a sudden my net fitness has increased, even though I'm giving away a bunch of stuff in order to get even more. Okay, so that's a new theory on how altruism could stay in place as a behavior that is costly to the individual.
Another thing that we've talked about is the fact that groups of people who aren't related to each other, we're not just talking about clans and families, but larger groups, when they cooperate with each other and are altruistic toward each other, as a group fare better than smaller, completely family, blood tie-centered groups.
You just reinvented Darwin's important theory that still has scholars scratching their heads, because he insisted it was group selection.
Oh, so that's what group selection is.
That's that theory, yeah. But you're absolutely right. It is a profound paradox in human evolution that we became as altruistic as we have. I did publish a paper using the very early small sample of hunter-gatherers that I had in my database probably 8-10 years ago, in which I showed that universally among hunter-gatherers, they preach in favor of altruism. We know it as the Golden Rule. The Golden Rule is a human universal. All human groups perceive the dangers of undue selfishness, so they preach. And basically, if you want to look at the preaching from an evolutionary standpoint, I preach for you to be altruistic so that I get stuff from you. But maybe, who knows what I'm up to?
It's funny because the way that so many of us are raised in a context where we are taught that you do the golden right, you do the golden rule, not because it will ultimately benefit you, but because it's the right thing to do in some sort of fundamental way.
Well, there is that ideological aspect, but keep in mind that the wording is do unto others as they would do unto you. And so the idea is partly it's to your benefit, because if you do good stuff, that gets reciprocated.
Right.
So it's a very gray area as to what people are up to with this golden rule stuff, because it's partly to get others to be altruistic when you might not necessarily meet them at that level. On the other hand, it's also something we deeply believe in because we have consciences.
We're talking to Christopher Bohm about hunter-gatherer morals. Now, one of the things that we haven't really talked about much when we talk about egalitarianism, are we talking about genuine egalitarianism that includes women?
With hunter-gatherers, we are talking about male egalitarianism. I have to cough that up as my first generalization. However, hunter-gatherer groups are very different in how women acquire political status vis-a-vis men and vis-a-vis other women. The Inuit, for example, beat their wives a great deal and dominate their wives. If you look at the Agta in the Philippines, these women hunters use dogs to hunt wild boar. Their hunting success is higher than all male groups when the women go out. And the women seem to have a very strong role, both at the band level in terms of group decisions and also within the family. And a lot of people tend to look at this as human nature, but I tend to think that it might be because the hunter role makes men ascendant in hunting bands, because it's a very dangerous thing to do. You basically need to take a lot of risks when you're hunting. You go out sometimes several days in a row, do nothing, it's arduous. You can also get hurt and so forth. So basically men are given a higher status because they're hunters, because the women are out gathering vegetable foods or small game, and it's pretty easy and relatively safe. So the males have a higher status, but the minute you have women doing full-time large game hunting, all of a sudden, with this particular group, now we only have this one group, and they are symbiotic with agriculturalists. They hunt meat, and then they trade it for grain. So they're nothing like Paleolithic hunters, but it's very suggestive. It suggests that maybe it's the hunting role rather than human nature that's actually causing these disparities. However, the males are adamant about not being bossed around by other males. Women, leaving aside the Agta, but if you look at Paleolithic type hunters that live today, you find that, for example, with the Bushmen or the San people of the Kalahari, that women have a relatively high status, but not quite as high as males. But the Inuit and many other groups, women are beaten or dominated by their husbands. So it's all over the map.
It's so interesting when you say that, okay, when in this group that you're talking about, when women do what's essentially men's work, which is big game hunting, they're as successful or more successful at it than the men, and they have higher status. And so then you look at our society and you look at all this data that's come out now that when women are on boards or in higher management of large companies, those companies are more successful and those women get respect. I mean, it just sounds like a parallel to me, and it still doesn't address the question of what would it take to have a society, and why can't we have a society where when women do things like teaching and raising children and all these non-dangerous, extremely important things, we can't have an egalitarian society.
Well, I think it'd be very interesting if you could ask that question of a hunter-gatherer. And they're smart enough and philosophical enough where they probably would have an answer for you, and a better one than I could give you.
What's been your own experience talking to and living with and studying hunter-gatherers?
Well, the closest I've come to living with and studying hunter-gatherers is my field research with the Navajo. Now, the Navajo still, to me, felt very much like hunter-gatherers in their worldview and their psychological orientation and so forth. But in fact, they had been ferocious raiders. They did a lot of slave trading. And before that, they were hunter-gatherers. And since then, of course, they've been given sheep by the U.S. government after the Long March and so on. And they become horticulturalists and pastoralists. But they were true hunter-gatherers. And their orientation was palpable. I could feel they were just so different. And they were very low-key. Among the Navajo, if you in any way try to raise yourself above other people, you're subject to possible witchcraft accusations. This was in the old days, of course. So they're very egalitarian, but I never saw the group cracking down on someone who stepped out of line, because nobody steps out of line.
When you look at hunter-gatherer morality and all the work you've done and all the studying, and then you look at our society, what vestiges of hunter-gatherer morality do you see? Is it something that's common? I mean, we're talking about tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of years of evolution where this is how people were living. I mean, hundreds of thousands of years of egalitarianism, at least male egalitarianism, being the norm, and then suddenly you get agriculture and a relatively recent, like what, something like 12,000 years old set of civilizations and rules that are quite different. So what remains?
Well, let's talk a little bit about the transition from nomadic hunter-gatherers to sedentary hunter-gatherers, because quite a bit of the story lies in that very small transition compared to the eventual development of civilization and so forth. When hunter-gatherers have environments that are so rich and productive that they can stay in one place and settle down and have a permanent home for the whole year, this is because they can store food. Storing food reduces interdependence of people to a great extent. Instead of sharing large game, they dry it and put it in a storeroom. And that's just one family does that. So they no longer are sharing everything at the group level. And on the other hand, they're storing food and they're staying in one place, and they can develop material wealth of various types, usually symbolic stuff, but still wealth to them. And sedentary hunter-gatherers tend to develop what we call big men. A big man, there are several types of big men. A big man is somebody who accumulates food in such large quantities and controls it that he can put on a feast, which makes his group put another group to shame.
The Godfather.
I don't know about how we could put that into the feasting concept. I'm racking my brain through all those movies.
My Daughter's Wedding.
Oh, okay. All right. but so you put on a big feast, and there is a social aggressive aspect to any large event like that. A Sicilian wedding. Basically, these big men are of two types. One is an egalitarian big man. That means the big man develops empires. Let's say he gains control of a whole lot of food, and his group can put on a feast, and it's better than the other group's feast, and the whole group loves him for this because they won. Okay, so he's serving the group, and yet in his role, he is becoming a wealthy man, and he starts throwing his weight around a little bit, but not too much. So the egalitarian aspect is eroding a bit because a nomadic hunting band, without all this food storage and wealth and so on, they wouldn't put up with that. The next thing that can happen is that the big man becomes so adept at keep maintaining wealth that he's able to become a real powerful leader. Now, he still does it by influence. He can't say off with their heads, but he's a powerful leader, and he can then assign his son as his successor. And once you have a hereditary system of leadership, then egalitarianism is gone because you start having social classes. You have a princely or noble class. You have a commoners. Some of the sedentary hunter-gatherers of the northwest coast of the United States actually have slaves they capture in war. So they have three major classes. Hunter-gatherers who are nomadic have no classes at all.
In the groups that do have classes, how are those classes similar and different to primate hierarchies?
The only classes you have among primates would be males and females.
I thought you had like an alpha male,
male. But a social class is a group of people who are different from another group of people on a hierarchical basis. And with any primate, it's a matter of individuals, not classes.
So now here we are in the class system pretty much everywhere, and many people rail against it, especially when it gets so skewed that some people have almost everything and the large group of people have almost nothing. So where does hunter-gatherer morality, like what does it look like now? Do we still have any of it?
Well, I have a hunter-gatherer morality myself in that I happen to not only study egalitarianism, but I sort of like it.
And a lot of people do.
Yeah.
I guess that's what I'm trying to get at. A lot of people really believe in egalitarianism.
Okay, keep in mind, however, that as societies get larger and more complex, things get more complicated and perhaps less predictable. Democracies are a way of bringing back hunter-gatherer egalitarianism at a practical, sensible level. So instead of saying, hey, we're going to have no classes and no strong leaders, we say, we know we got to have them to run a show this big, but we're going to put some rules in effect in our Constitution that say nobody can do this or that to anybody else, so that you have guarantees of personal liberty. Now, somehow in America, people don't vote with their wallets. Not in the last 20 years. They vote ideologically. And, of course, during the Cold War, we had the specter of Marxism, but it also, I think, it made people aware of economic differences in a way that we aren't today. So you have lots of people of relatively small means who absolutely favor giving more and more wealth to the top tier. And to me, that's where I start scratching my head as a poor hunter-gatherer who's here on this planet with all these hierarchies and so forth.
Christopher Bohm is director of the Jane Goodall Research Center. He's a professor of biological sciences and anthropology at the University of Southern California in Los Angeles. And he's author of the book Moral Origins, The Evolution of Virtue, Altruism, and Shame. Christopher, thank you so much for being with us.
It was delightful being here.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design.